This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with a constitutional law scholar on how Trump's executive orders are faring in the courts. Our guest, Steve Rohde, a co-host here on Law and Disorder, includes in his report the first of those executive orders to be decided just a few days ago by the U.S. Supreme Court.
We also dive into the recent presidential threats to cut funding to U.S. colleges that permit so-called illegal protests on campus, exploring the implications for free speech and higher education.
Attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard of the D.C.-based Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and the Center for Protest Law and Litigation will demystify the constitutionality of Donald Trump's recent threats.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
The number of active lawsuits in federal courts challenging Trump administration arguments has now topped 100. In 21 of those cases, judges have already issued temporary restraining orders or preliminary injunctions, effectively stopping, at least for now, parts of Trump's agenda. For example, as reported in the New York Times this past Sunday, trial court judges have blocked by now Trump's mass firings of civil servants, Musk's access to sensitive federal data, the relocation of transgendered women inmates to men's prisons, the pursuit of immigrants inside houses of worship, and the freezing of up to $3 trillion of federal funding to the states. And in a very important case, a federal judge entered a final judgment reinstating the head of the federal watchdog agency. And just yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration, halting the sending of those billions of foreign aid dollars. But it must be pointed out that in a number of preliminary victories against Trump's actions, the government, though losing the first round in the cases, have nevertheless stalled in obeying the court's orders. And Trump himself posted the absolutist notion that, and I quote, "he who saves his country does not violate any law," close quote. Five of the judges who have ruled against Trump were appointed by Republican presidents, one by Trump himself. As a result of Trump's losing record in court cases so far, there is now talk on the right of seeking to impeach judges who rule against the Trump administration. And the number of death threats judges are experiencing from the public have gone up alarmingly as well. So today on Law and Disorder Radio, we examine the more important court cases challenging the attempts of the Trump administration to deconstruct the United States both legally and politically. And our guest is one of our co-hosts here on Law and Disorder, Mr. Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a civil rights activist, author, and constitutional scholar. He practiced civil rights law for almost 50 years. He currently serves as chair of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. He is also past president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and the past chair of Death Penalty Focus, as well as the group Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. But today, Mr. Rohde is speaking only for himself. So, Steve Rohde, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder as our guest today.
Jim, thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
First off, Steve, what can you tell us about the very recent Supreme Court ruling on the billions that have been appropriated in foreign aid that Trump does not want sent? And also about the Dellinger case, of course.
Yes. Well, this is the first full dress test in the United States Supreme Court of Donald Trump's overly expansive vision of the presidency, in a direct clash with Congress and with the court system itself. Fortunately, I consider it the rule of law is fighting back. Bright, smart lawyers and intelligent judges are consistently ruling against Trump. The USAID case is particularly important because Trump lost at this stage. Justice Roberts and Justice Barrett, two of the conservatives, one of whom he appointed, voted in the majority. What's important about this decision is the breakdown of the justices. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Barrett, who are usually considered part of the six supermajority of conservatives on the court, they voted with the liberals, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and Justice Jackson, to create the five-member majority, which is upholding the order of the lower courts to enforce the payments already in the system for USAID aid and support to foreign countries and foreign people who are struggling. So I consider the decision very important. It shows a willingness, at least at this stage in that litigation, for two of the conservatives to create a majority to oppose what Trump is doing. On the other side, we had an angry dissent from Justice Alito, speaking for Justice Thomas, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. Justice Alito wrote that he was stunned by the majority opinion. Frankly, as far as the rule of law is concerned, any time Justice Alito is stunned is a good day. He then wrote a deceptive opinion. He misrepresented the facts in the lower court, and it was not a good display of judicial temperament or judicial analysis. That's an important case, and we're all going to have to follow it. An equally important case, the one you mentioned, is teed up for a head-on clash in the Supreme Court. And this involves an Office of Special Counsel. This was formed many years ago. 12 presidents have appointed special counsels to this office. It's an independent agency that exposes unethical and unlawful practices directed at civil servants, and it helps ensure whistleblowers who expose fraud, waste, and abuse by government agencies can do so without reprisals. Well, ironically, the reprisal took place when Donald Trump fired Hampton Dellinger. Now the courts have twice, in this case, just Judge Amy Berman Jackson wrote a 67-page decision on March 1st, ordering, as a final judgment, ordering Hampton Dellinger to stay in office and to continue his service. He was appointed for a five-year term. It's an unusual appointment. He was appointed by President Biden in March of 2024, and his term was supposed to continue to 2029. This will tee up in the United States Supreme Court a head-on clash, because President Trump and his lawyers claim the president has unrestricted power to remove executive officers like this. And I think we're all going to have to watch that case very carefully.
Within a week or so ago, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, it sued the Trump administration for transferring 10 undocumented immigrants to the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. And in commenting on this case, you have written, and I quote, "This case draws much-needed attention to one of the United States' longest-running human rights violations, now compounded by Trump's cruel immigration policy," close quote. What do you mean by that?
Yes, this is the case of Escalona versus Noem, filed on March 1st. It's an extraordinarily important case, filed by the ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the International Refugee Assistance Project. The case lays out and demands or seeks an emergency motion to stay the transfer of those 10 undocumented immigrants. Those 10 are in the system. They are pursuing their legal rights. Yet Donald Trump wants to put them beyond the reach of the United States. At least that's what he believes. The lawyers have explained that it violates the Immigration and Nationality Act, And it violates the Fifth Amendment substantive due process protections. This would put these individuals in dangerous conditions beyond access to their lawyers. It does draw attention to the ugly fact that Guantanamo Bay persists. It's one of the most serious blemishes on United States history. And here, Trump is only trying to extend that outrage, and all of us are hopeful that the ACLU and the others will win a stay of those transfers.
Let's talk about the Trump administration's determination to get rid of programs seeking more diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace. Democratic attorney generals from 16 states have issued a detailed memo refuting Trump's executive order eliminating DEI policies and programs, and a number of cases have been brought challenging various executive orders targeting DEI. What can you tell us about the strength of these cases and their likely outcome?
These cases are strong, and they have begun to win temporary injunctions preventing large swaths of what Trump is trying to do regarding diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility, and belonging. I use that full term. I despise Trump's reduction of the importance of diversity to a simple acronym. So a series of attorneys general have sued over this. The American Federation of Teachers has filed an extraordinary lawsuit. In their complaint, it's a robust defense of diversity, broadly speaking. Diversity programs, recruitment, training in our colleges and universities, in our workplaces, is not illegal. The Supreme Court did make a ruling a few years ago that race could not be taken into consideration in the admission to colleges and universities. But for years, the kind of diversity training and recruitment has been upheld by the courts. It's been upheld and enforced by the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Education. Industry and business has recognized the value of programs which are meant to ease the injuries that have been visited upon people of color, women, people with disabilities. We do not have a level playing field in the United States, and we certainly don't have a colorblind society that would justify dismantling all of these programs. President Trump is running roughshod through the Department of Education. On the teaching side, he wants to impose a single, what he calls patriotic view of American history. When he does that, he's erasing true American history. He does it to dumb down those entering college and, frankly, to dumb down the entire American people. They need more comprehensive education on the stain of slavery, on the dispossession of Native Americans, and on the discrimination that's occurred throughout our history leading up to today. I'm encouraged by the injunctions that several judges have issued against these executive orders. I think, in a way, it's a time for us to speak up in favor of diversity, equity, inclusion, etc. And I hope the courts hold on, and then the test will come in the Supreme Court.
Well, Steve, as reported in last week's New York Times, just in recent days, more than 40 lawsuits have been filed seeking to erect a bulwark in the federal courts against what they term Trump's, and I quote, blitzkrieg of executive orders that have upended much of the federal government and challenged the constitutional system of checks and balances, close quote. And among those cases, of course, are five of special interest. So I'd like you to review those cases for us, if you would, today. There's Trump's effort to eliminate automatic citizenship for babies born in the U.S. There's the male-only prisons, sending a transgender female to male-only prisons. There's the Maryland case having to do with the nationwide enforcement of the gender-affirming care for persons under 19, and so on and so forth. Talk to us about these cases, if you would.
Yes, and let me begin almost with a sixth case, because just last Thursday, on March 6th, in New York versus Trump, a judge in Rhode Island extended an order preventing Trump from freezing billions of dollars in congressionally approved funds in 22 states that had filed that lawsuit. The judge called it executive overreach. It put the executive above Congress, which was unacceptable. And just briefly, that judge quoted a prior lower court judge who said, "The president does not have unilateral authority to refuse to spend the funds appropriated by Congress." Well, the judge who wrote that was Justice Kavanaugh in 2013. So he'll have his own words quoted back to him when that case reaches the Supreme Court. The case on transgender transfers to male prisons is an ugly example of the cruelty of so much of what Trump has done in the last 50 days. We can talk about the legal principles and explain them as you and I are doing today, but let's not forget that real people living real lives are the ones that are suffering by reason of Trump's executive orders. On February 18, a judge, a Reagan appointee, issued a preliminary injunction blocking the Department of Justice from transferring 12 transgender female inmates into male-only prisons. That was triggered by an order from Trump after he issued the statement that there are only two sexes in biology. He's not as good a biologist anymore than he is as a constitutional scholar. Fortunately, that injunction has been extended, and we can hope it will hold up through the courts. You did mention birthright citizenship. This is a fundamental attack on the Constitution, and if there was any originalist reading of the Constitution, it is that the 14th Amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. That's been the law of the land since the 14th Amendment was enacted. It does protect any child, even the child of an undocumented immigrant living in the United States, to birthright citizenship. I'm hopeful the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously will reject the attack on that. You mentioned another cruel case of FBI agents. Trump tried to out almost 6,000 employees that worked on the January 6th prosecutions and the Trump classified documents case. These are hardworking FBI agents and others. I know you and I historically have problems with the FBI from time to time, going all the way back to J. Edgar Hoover. But in these cases, they were pursuing real crimes, and Trump is trying to out them, which would expose their names and personal information, which the violent people who were pardoned by Trump could use against them. Having filed a very strong lawsuit, they were able to reach an agreement with the government lawyers not to disclose their identities pending a hearing on March 27, and we're going to watch for that case as well. Perhaps finally, a U.S. district judge in Massachusetts blocked the Trump administration from implementing the Trump-Musk deferred resignations program, trying to coax and coerce federal employees to accept 8 months of pay and then be forced to resign in September. That injunction is in place, and it will be tested up through the courts. These are key decisions. Judges are uniformly ruling in favor of the challengers and against the Trump administration.
Steve Rudy, the reaction, of course, to Trump's failures largely in the court system of what he's trying to do and what Musk is trying to do has led not only to more death threats being received by federal judges around the country, but also efforts and suggestions by Republicans especially that these judges should be impeached. Talk to us about that.
This is a very dangerous development. This is the work of Republicans in the House of Representatives. They are seeing the news that we're talking about today. They are seeing judges uphold the Constitution, and they're trying to retaliate against these judges just for their legal rulings. Representative Andy Ogles, a Republican of Tennessee, is threatening to file articles of impeachment against Judge John Bates, a George W. Bush appointee, by the way. It's Judge Bates who ordered the Trump administration to restore government websites with public health information, which Trump had removed because he opposed gender-affirming care. Another representative, Andrew Clyde, a Republican of Georgia, is threatening to pursue impeachment against Judge John McConnell, who I just mentioned issued the orders blocking the Trump administration from freezing on federal spending. This is very dangerous. The Constitution allows for the impeachment of judges, but it's the same standard applied to presidents and other federal officers. They must have committed a high crime or misdemeanor. Their judicial rulings themselves are clothed with immunity. There is no high crime and misdemeanor in issuing a ruling, even one that I might disagree with. But in this case, these are well-founded rulings. This is really from the playbook of Trump attacking judges, as well as Elon Musk, who issued a message on X, quote, and many of these words are in full caps, quote, "If any judge anywhere can block every presidential order everywhere, we do not have democracy. We have tyranny of the judiciary." It's a dangerous threat against the courts. I do fear for the physical safety of judges, and it's something all of us should condemn.
Well, Steve, we've been talking about a number of cases, and so many of them have gone against what the Trump administration is trying to do. Why do you think that is? What do you think it signifies? Why do you think the court has taken the positions it has taken generally? And what might it mean for future efforts on the part of Trump to do what he's doing, which is basically deconstruct the government of the United States?
Trump is following the playbook set decades ago by the Federalist Society, by a handful of conservative judges. They've dressed it up in what they call the unitary executive theory. It's an extreme interpretation of the power of the president to be above and beyond all other branches of government. Ironically, for those conservatives who follow originalism, it ignores the actual terms of the Constitution itself. Congress is empowered to make laws and to appropriate funds to implement those laws. And it is the sworn duty of the President of the United States to faithfully execute the laws. Those are the terms of the Constitution as well as the oath the President takes. So that's the structure of our government. It's held fast for many years. There have been abuses on all sides. But the unitary executive theory purports to make the president at the top of the executive branch, but also that no congressional act can impinge on the president's duty. Congress cannot restrain or limit or set conditions on the laws that it passes. One of the most important we haven't mentioned specifically is the Impoundment Act. There have been past precedents when Congress appropriated money for a particular program or government department who've been upset by those policy decisions. And so Congress several years ago passed the Impoundment Act, which expressly says that once funds have been appropriated, a president must spend them and implement them to further congressional policy. Well, the unitary executive theory is at war with that approach. They believe the president can judge which congressional acts to follow, which appropriations to spend. You can immediately see when we describe it what a danger that poses to the separation of powers and to the checks and balances that the founders were sensible enough to create. Now, unfortunately, there are at least two justices, Thomas and Gorsuch, who have flirted with the unitary executive theory. I'm very concerned what will happen in a full dress litigation that reaches the Supreme Court. I'm pleased that a couple of the cases already have understood that Congress has a role to play and the president must abide by that. That's what we're up against. We are testing the guardrails of our democratic system. As we speak today, those guardrails are holding, but I tremble to think if in future cases, five of the justices adopt the unitary executive theory.
Well, Steve, the general public is as concerned about this apparently as you are, because the streets have been filled with demonstrations. As we wrap up, I want to mention that you've recently written, and I quote, "Lawsuits are necessary, but not sufficient in the battle to stop Trump from destroying our democracy," close quote. Explain that a little bit further, and isn't that consistent with what we are already seeing on the streets?
As much time today as we spent on the brilliant work of hardworking lawyers and judges who are following the law, that is one pillar of the resistance we all are part of in the era of the second Trump administration. We have to see people in the streets. We have to see public demonstrations. People can engage in a range of activities. Some are sitting home writing postcards for the election of Susan Crawford in the Wisconsin Supreme Court election. Others are organizing on Main Street to protest what Trump is doing. Some, like I know Jim Lafferty, are organizing protests in front of the Tesla dealership in Los Angeles. We've always known that the Constitution begins with the words, "We the people." That's where it rests. Supreme Court Justice Jackson, in dissenting from the presidential immunity case, said that the ultimate barrier for democracy is the people. And I encourage listeners, I'm proud of Law and Disorder because it's a vehicle to get information out to the people so they're ready. They are meeting and writing to their congressmen. They're going to town halls. They're writing letters to the editor. They are speaking up. That empowers each individual. You feel stronger and less hopeless, and it is important to the dynamic of American democracy.
Yes, once again, it does come down to we the people. Steve Rohde, thank you so much. You've just been a wonderful guest on this topic. I thank you so much. I know how much work you do in preparing when you write about this topic and speak about this topic. And I thank you for not only being our co-host here frequently on Law and Disorder, but for being our very special guest today as well. Thank you, Steve Rohde.
Well, thank you, Jim, and thanks for all that you do. But as we are recording this program, there's breaking news, and unfortunately, it's not good. The Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia Circuit has granted the Trump administration an emergency stay in the Dellinger case. This is the case of the Special Watchdog Council. Three judges of that court, one appointed by Reagan, one appointed by Trump, but one appointed by Obama, granted the Trump administration an emergency stay removing Mr. Dellinger from his office. And worse than that, Mr. Dellinger immediately announced that he was resigning as special counsel. He would no longer fight this case in the Court of Appeals or in the Supreme Court. It's very disappointing, Jim, as hopeful as we are about these cases. We need people to courageously continue the fight, and this one is a setback. So stay tuned as we continue to follow this important effort to resist the Trump administration.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
On March 4th, Donald Trump threatened to cut federal funding to colleges that permit what he calls illegal protests. His statement on social media sparked a wave of reactions from civil rights groups as a direct attack on fundamental freedoms. In his post, Trump echoed ideas from prior executive orders, including his 2019 order and one issued this January that targeted pro-Palestinian student protests on campuses, calling them anti-Semitic. But Trump's latest comments go further, asserting that any protest deemed illegal would lead to harsh consequences, including the imprisonment of agitators and the expulsion or arrest of students. The details, however, are unclear, especially around how the government would define illegal protests or how it would enforce such a measure. Trump's latest threat has reignited concerns about the balance between freedom of speech and government intervention on college campuses. It raises questions about the rights of students, faculty, and protesters in the context of broader political and social movements. To help us understand the constitutional implications of Trump's statements, we're joined by civil rights attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. Mara is the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and the Center for Protest Law and Litigation in Washington, D.C. Mara, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We hope that you can help us understand the legal basis for President Trump's recent claim that protests on college campuses could be deemed illegal.
Well, I think there's a real question, right, as to whether there is a legal basis. In fact, we would say that the administration's effort to chill, disrupt, punish, threaten free speech activities that occur on college campuses are fundamentally unconstitutional and not legal.
So, Mara, what defines a legal versus illegal protest, and who determines that?
Well, a protest is an expression of collective action, speech, First Amendment protected activity. And when it comes to campuses, of course, you have different circumstances that will apply depending on the nature of the campus. So if we're talking about protests on campus of public universities, there is a First Amendment protection for students, obviously within the bounds of a university's student code, but they do have First Amendment protections. On private universities, the universities have a great deal more leeway as to how they wish to control student speech, because there is not necessarily a First Amendment protection. However, on any campus at all, there has to be uniformity in application of rules. There has to be no use of sort of a post hoc creation of rules to punish a particular activity that otherwise would go without any concern at all. And of course, these are the types of things that we're seeing across the board in the United States, which is universities coming after students who are engaging in calls for divestment from genocide, who are demanding freedom and liberation for the Palestinian people, who are condemning the U.S.-backed Israeli genocide in Gaza. And those students are being targeted on campus after campus after campus because of their viewpoints. And once you are targeting someone because of their viewpoints, then you are engaging in, you know, unlawful or improper conduct, which is going to fall under different rules depending on whether you have a constitutional protection, whether your protections lay in a Title VI claim, or some other basis to show that a university is targeting someone because of the content of their speech, not because of the nature of the activity.
Maura, can you remind us of Trump's 2019 order, and did it have any impact?
Well, what Trump has done is issue recent executive orders, and there are references back to a 2019 order. The 2019 order was an effort that's been sought in multiple different venues, which is the implementation of a particular definition of anti-Semitism that is not actually what anti-Semitism is. I think we can all agree that anti-Semitism is abhorrent. But what they have tried to do is say that anti-Semitism includes criticism of the state of Israel, includes stating that Israel is an apartheid or racist or colonial endeavor. Now, criticism of Israel is, of course, not anti-Semitic. Criticism of Zionism is not anti-Jewish. These are distinctions that are important but are intentionally blurred in order to wrap up criticism of Israel and of its genocide in Gaza into a way to say that this is anti-Semitic. And so that's what the Trump administration is trying to do over and over. It tried to do it with the adoption of the IHRA definition that I just described in 2019. And now, of course, we've had these recent executive orders, including the January 29th order to combat anti-Semitism, which talks about targeting students. In the accompanying fact sheet, it talks about targeting students on campuses, frankly, based on their viewpoints. It talks about targeting viewpoints that are, quote, leftist and, quote, anti-American or, quote, left-wing. And similarly, there was the January 20th executive order protecting the U.S. from foreign terrorists that has a section where they talk about protecting the American people from actions of foreign nationals who, quote, call for the overthrow or replacement of the culture on which our Constitution stands, which, of course, like, what does that mean? That's just like a rallying cry of white supremacists.
Mara, last fall, we saw the rise of encampments on various college campuses, and this drew a lot of criticism, a lot of reaction by the police and university authorities. Are encampments a legal form of protest versus the notion that they constitute trespass, as many universities have alleged?
Well, every university has its own like student handbook or guidelines as to student conduct or community conduct or whatever they want to call it. And students regularly sit upon, occupy, otherwise use public spaces on campus. What has happened with the encampments is the universities basically sought to make that a violation of their rules, targeting actions, again, based on viewpoint that they might otherwise not be concerned about had it occurred for some other purpose, for some other either non-political purpose or other political purpose that wasn't about the expression of calling for divestment of the universities from genocide. So the rules are based on university by university, but, you know, in fact, using, you know, if you look at some universities, they're punishing students even for actions that are occurring off campus. And when they were targeting encampments on campus, you know, they've been coming down with an extremely violent, heavy hand, bringing in the police, sicking the violence of the police on their own students. In some instances, like at UCLA, allowing right-wing fascist mobs to attack their own students. So, you know, this question about is an encampment okay or not okay? I think all we have to do is really look at the extreme violent response from the universities, the criminalization by the universities, and then the ongoing disciplinary processes where they have sought to seriously punish students really for the content of their speech and not for their conduct.
How do you see potential legal challenges if this is enforced to cutting federal funding for universities that do allow certain protests? And do you see lawsuits happening also by students? And I know this would depend on whether it's a public or private institution.
Well, the funding streams that go to universities from the federal government have particular grants or appropriations or processes, none of which, as far as I know, allow the president or the executive branch to just cut them by fiat, which is what he's threatening to do. So they would have to be able to have a basis, a legal basis that allows the ending of funding to a university within whatever that process was for the grant of that funding to begin with. There are certain circumstances, like under Title IX or Title VI, where there are violations of rights, where the federal government can threaten and, in fact, withdraw funding from a university based on a finding within those processes. But it is not that he can snap his fingers and just cut funding. And again, even in that, you can't target based on viewpoint. So the administration can't simply say that they are assessing that all speech in support of Palestine and against genocide falls into some category that they can just withdraw funding. And that's what they're trying to do over and over again. That's why this all wraps back into the attempt to say that this speech, which actually stands in support of human rights, is necessarily anti-Semitic when it is not anti-Semitic. And of course, it's impossible for them to even address the reality that the movement of students, this powerful, brave movement of students, is made up of students from all backgrounds and all faith backgrounds, includes, you know, students who are Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, and non-believers. Like, how they are able to say that across the board everyone is anti-Semitic, you know, of course, it's an absurdity. It's just simply the abuse of that term as it has been abused and exploited for years in order to push a political agenda in terms of oppressing the Palestinian people, and more crucially, in the United States, trying to suppress speech in the United States.
Mara, I think our listeners would be interested in understanding two different legal doctrines that are at play here. One is the concept of unconstitutional conditions. Doesn't it violate the First Amendment to tie federal funding to giving up constitutional rights and accepting impingement on those rights? And the second doctrine is one you've mentioned but is worth expanding on, which is viewpoint discrimination. What has the Supreme Court had to say about viewpoint discrimination, and why has it consistently been recognized as a violation of the First Amendment?
Well, it is acknowledged that the government cannot, you know, basically put its thumb on the scale of speech and debate in as much as it cannot suppress a particular point of view just because a president doesn't like it. Now, that's not to say that we don't see that, but that's exactly where these constitutional challenges come in. So under the First Amendment, people of the United States are entitled to have robust debate, thinking, speech, participation, rallies, association, to be able to challenge their government, to be able to actually raise positions in opposition to what the government may be doing. And it is crucial and fundamental under democratic principles that this exists. And what this administration is trying to do is overtly use the authority of the state, to use state authority to target people based on viewpoint. So it is not a neutral application of law, nor it is a neutral application of like state enforcement authority. They are over and over again through not only the executive orders that I mentioned, but other executive orders and just directives that are coming from agency appointees and other administration officials, making it clear that they are taking action based on punishing viewpoints with which they disagree. And that is fundamentally unconstitutional. The issue of the ability of people to engage in First Amendment rights is deeply tied in as an element of viewpoint discrimination, in that you simply can't have viewpoint discrimination without running afoul of the First Amendment.
Mara, as a quick follow-up, a lot of college campuses are saying all they're doing is establishing time, place, and manner restrictions. Explain time, place, and manner, which have generally been upheld as not violating the First Amendment, compared to what is actually happening on many college campuses.
To engage in First Amendment activities, the government may put restrictions on the ability to engage in First Amendment activities based on a time or place or manner restriction, like the idea that this is used if like people want to rally in a public park, but that public park is already being used for some other purpose. The government could say, well, there's a time, place, or manner restriction on the rally in the public park, or that it's occurring late at night and it's going to disturb people, or something like that. But it has to be, again, a neutral application. You can't have a restriction, though, that is, again, based on viewpoint to say, well, you're saying you're engaged in pro-Palestine speech, and so now we're going to crack down on you targeting because of that speech. And that obviously, if it's overt and they're saying we're targeting you because of your pro-Palestine speech, well, that's overt. But it's also obvious when they are doing this because they have allowed similar actions or activities to occur. But the only time that they're cracking down is when it comes to the nature of the speech. So that's the other way that this gets argued, that they'll say it's a time, place, manner restriction. But in reality, you can show that that time, place, or manner restriction has not been imposed on similarly situated or other groups or people who have engaged in similar actions, like they haven't been punished for them.
If you're just joining us, this is Heidi Boghossian, and my co-host Stephen Rohde and I are interviewing Mara Verheyden-Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Mara, can you tell our listeners a bit about the work the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has done and the Center for Protest Law and Litigation?
Yes, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund is a nonprofit organization that I co-founded 30 years ago, and a lot of our work involves defense of movements, of organizations, of activists who are fighting for justice in the United States. Our work falls frequently at the intersection of First and Fourth Amendment rights, the right of people to be able to speak out, and the imposition of police violence and repression against people for speaking out. We do a lot of work in terms of getting people access to space so that the movement has room to breathe and speak and grow, as well as affirmative constitutional rights litigation to vindicate fundamental constitutional rights. We also do work defending people who are targeted and criminally prosecuted because of their First Amendment activities. So it's really an effort to defend the movement and fight for the movement in the United States, understanding that when we look at all of the changes in our society that we so deeply value, they've come because people were in the streets, because people stood together, because they were able to speak out, because they were able to fight for the future that they believed in. And we launched the Center for Protest Law and Litigation a few years ago to really highlight and focus on those areas of work. So that is a great deal of what we do. We also do a lot of work that involves transparency work in terms of public records and exposés on government misconduct, as well as other areas involving discrimination.
Mara, assume there are universities that are actually dedicated to free and robust open debate and discussion. What can universities affirmatively do to safeguard free speech on their campuses?
Well, we would all like to think that universities and colleges in the United States, in fact, uphold all of the language that they put in their brochures and their policies about their great admiration and love for academic freedom and free speech, regardless if they're a public or private university. This is, of course, what universities always publicly champion, that that is what they stand for, that they stand for thought, for debate, for differing viewpoints. But what we're seeing is the opposite. And for the universities and the colleges that really want to stand by their students, they should be standing up to the administration. They should not be calling the police on the students. They should be meeting with the students and listening to their demands. If we think about the demands of the divestment movement against apartheid South Africa, and that was a very powerful student movement, universities ultimately, many of them took steps to divest from apartheid. But here, over and over again, the universities are refusing to talk to the students, are refusing to divest from apartheid, are refusing to even frequently disclose what their investments actually are when it comes to Israel as an apartheid entity that is, you know, discriminating against and oppressing Palestinian people in historic Palestine. But what they could do would be to stand up for the students, to say, this is who we are as a university. This is actually who we are as the conscience of a university. And we are going to abide by academic freedom and free speech and support our students rather than punish them.
Mara, we just have a few minutes remaining, but if Trump somehow were to institute a policy whereby he could cut funds to universities for on-campus protest, does this have a longer-term implication for the rest of us on free expression?
At any point, an administration that the government of the United States is using the power of the state, using its authority to punish, stifle, repress, criminalize, defund based on the point of view that is being expressed here, the point of view that's being expressed by students on campus, it is exceptionally dangerous. It is authoritarian. It is a death knell for democratic expression in the United States, for fundamental First Amendment expression in the United States. I mean, what they're doing is walking around like kind of gangsterism. I mean, that's what this administration is. It's like a form of gangsterism, both nationally and internationally, where they're just bulldozing everything and threatening everyone. If you don't do what I say, I am going to punish you, rather than actually abiding by the law and legal process. So the dangers here are paramount. And you can see this carrying itself out both on campuses where they're threatening the universities. And so many universities, of course, caved and capitulated and threw their students and their faculty under the bus the moment that they were asked to by the right-wing Congress in the last term. I think we'll see a lot more of that. And you can imagine this now happening to basically create an orthodoxy of thought, an orthodoxy of belief, that what the administration says is proper thought, proper belief, proper expression is the only thing that would be allowed. And any opposition will be punished, will be criminalized, will be suppressed.
Mara, do you believe the threat to expel American students, to imprison them, to deport some of them, is that legally enforceable, or will it face significant hurdles in court?
I believe all of these efforts will face significant hurdles in court because each and every one of these is grounded on violation of First Amendment, of the basic rights of people in the United States to be able to speak out. And each and every one of these efforts to target students, target anyone because of the content of their speech, to punish them because of the content of their speech, to target for state investigation or the imposition of, you know, state sanction because of the content of their speech runs afoul of the First Amendment. And this will be challenged.
Mara, to follow up on that, what are the prospects in the United States Supreme Court where these cases are going to end up? There are six arch conservatives, three liberals, but in some cases, that court, including the conservatives, says it believes in the First Amendment. How do you see these cases shaping up when they reach the Supreme Court?
Well, everybody says they believe in the First Amendment. I mean, one of Trump's executive orders was also about, on his first day, was about like the government not imposing restrictions on free speech and the First Amendment. So, you know, we all know what that means. They mean the First Amendment for some and not for others. And when it comes to the Supreme Court, it's a real question. I mean, the reality is when you look at First Amendment jurisprudence from the different justices on this court, there has been frequently rulings that support the First Amendment, that take a strong position or a bright line rule in support of the First Amendment, that have included very conservative judges. It is not necessarily a province of liberal versus conservative across the board. It also depends, obviously, on what the underlying fact pattern is, as we know, and what they believe the outcome will turn on. So I don't think we can say with certainty one way or the other. But it is something that the justices know and have to consider, which is when they approve violations of the First Amendment, when they approve viewpoint targeting and discrimination and repression, it is a dangerous game, and it can be applied in one direction or another direction. The question I think we really have to ask is, how much is this administration and the, you know, extremists on the court, like, how far are they going to go for it? Is there going to be a decision where they decide, yeah, we're going to green light everything that this administration wants to do, regardless of how much this steamrolls basic democratic principles that, frankly, keep the country afloat?
Mara, we've run out of our allotted time. How can our listeners follow your work?
We encourage people to sign up for breaking email alerts at justiceonline.org and to follow us on social media at the PCJF, as we are also looking at legal challenges that are essential here. If people want to stay abreast of that work, again, please follow us at the PCJF or sign up at justiceonline.org.
Keep up the great work, and we'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.